This show was first broadcast on Free FM 89.0 Hamilton, New Zealand's community access radio station. For more information on our station and the wide range of programs, visit freefm.org.nz.
This is In Deep, a series of conversations about ideas, thoughts, feelings, time, and place. Hello, you're listening to In Deep. I'm Andrew Johnston, and my guest today, for the second week in a row, is Mr. Paul Judge. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much.
And we're continuing our exploration of the sounds and life and times of Van Morrison.
Van the Man.
Van the Man. Paul, last week we were looking at them, Van's rise to prominence as a teenager and as a young adult with them, a band that, well, inspired a lot of musicians, didn't they?
Yes, they were the sort of, he was 18, 19 years old, and he formed this rhythm and blues outfit in Belfast, and they had a number of hits. There was an American producer called Burt Burns, we'll talk about later on the special relationship that Van Morrison had with Burt Burns.
Or BB is to his friends, probably.
Right, and he came over to Belfast and produced some of their hits, Here Comes the Night.
Burt Burns and Belfast.
That's right. Yeah, they hired him. Decca hired him. Them were hired, actually, as a result of Decca missing out on the Beatles. And the Decca guy, Dick Rowe, went on a frantic search for the next Beatles, and Them were one of the bands that were signed.
So is Dick Rowe still alive?
I believe he is, yeah. He's, I believe he is.
Yeah, he must get heartily sick of hearing, oh, you're the guy,
It's really nice. I saw it listed the other day, one of the great commercial failures of all time. You know, they missed out on the Beatles. But anyway, they signed the Stones and they signed Them and Van Morrison. You know, they were the Belfast punks of their day. And, and they make the punks of the 70s look pretty tame, actually, when you read about their antics. God. And they toured America. They had this tour set up in America, and they sort of capitalized on the beat boom of, you know, the British beat boom, you know, the popularity of it in the States. And they were treated like real pop stars in some of those places, like, you know, in Arizona and places that they went to. But the thing is, they sort of turned to custard because they weren't getting paid a very good deal. You know, Phil Solomon, the Decca guy who was their manager, was not paying them a great deal. Partly Van Morrison's fault. He sort of resisted signing with, he signed up with a contract that with a fixed fee, you know, per gig and so on. And then they realised they were making much more money than they realised. And of course, Phil Solomon was taking it all. And so there was a point where Van stepped in and took the door sales money and kept it. And then Phil Solomon, you know, the Decca guy, he was over in London and you know, them were in LA doing a 2-week stint at the Whiskey A Go-Go Club, where he actually played with the Doors, believe it or not. The Doors were fronting for them. And this is before the Doors were famous. But Morrison kept the money, wouldn't give it to the manager, their Tommy Scott, their sort of touring manager, and to pay the fees to them. So they just kept this door money, and Phil Solomon back in London got these solicitors onto it, and there was this big sort of court case threatened. They ended up settling out of court, but it ruined the relationship, and they ended up, you know, once they'd sort of ditched, Decca ditched them, basically, and they were without a manager, and they were sort of managing themselves. They went, after that, they did a few more gigs. They played the Fillmore East, you know, Bill Graham's Fillmore in San Francisco. They ended up with about $17,000 US, and they went. They had a gig in Hawaii, and this is, you know, five Irish boys. I think it was five in the band.
It was $17,000.
$17,000 in Hawaii, and they spent half of it on cocktails. There's a great story about Hawaii, and they're just getting completely blasted on the beach.
I mean, listen, $14,000 in the late 1960s.
Yeah, and they spent half of that money on cocktails in the hotels in Hawaii. And then they went back and they did, you know, they were notorious. They were just notorious. They went back and did a number of other gigs around the States, and then they sort of finally went back with the tails between the legs to London, and they were so broke by the stage that two of them had to scrounge together the money from their manager. their solicitor, because they'd hired a solicitor to battle Phil Solomon. That's what they did. And they had to scrounge the money off the solicitor to get their air tickets back home. You know, this is how broke they were. So they all ended up back in Belfast, just totally, you know, they'd been former pop stars, and Van Morrison especially, who was a very prone to depressive moods and heavy drinking bouts and so on. It wasn't really the best, it wasn't the greatest time for him. But I thought we should play, start this by playing one of the great Them recordings, you know, because they were a fantastic blues outfit. They had a number of lineup changes, but there was a key core group, you know, Van on vocals, Billy Harrison on guitar, Alan Henderson on bass, and a guy called Pat McCauley on drums, and they were the core band. They were replaced, the American tour, there were a number of those people weren't there, they were replaced by a number of others, but essentially that core group, the first lineup of them, were just, they were as good as the Stones, there's no doubt about it. Some say better. I mean, you listen to this track, Mystic Eyes. It was actually one of the singles that they released in the States.
Mystic Eyes. That's Them with Mystic Eyes, coming to the end of their illustrious career. Well, crashing to an end.
Yes. Well, you know, that's sort of a good example of the kind of bluesy thing they were able to do. You know,
I mean, you can imagine that live on stage at the Fillmore East.
Absolutely.
A few drinks in you, a couple of joints, maybe a tab of LSD.
Oh yeah, that's right. I mean, we were coming into the pre-hippie era here. You know, 1966. It was all happening. It was, you know, the rise of boutiques and cafes and nightclubs and things in LA, and of course in Belfast as well. You know, Belfast was keen to become part of swinging London. I believe. And, you know, Van sort of went back to Belfast at this time, and he had this money. The only money he had left, he spent on this expensive tape recorder. You know, and there's descriptions of it from, you know, he invited Alan Henderson around to have a play with it, or one of the other guitarists in Belfast at that time, and he describes it as having this sort of wooden veneer and, you know, this stuff, you know, little knobs and things on it, like a recording studio. You know?
Yeah,
it's like the latest recording tape recorder that he sat in his mother's lounge and recorded, improvised all these songs on it.
Of course, the youth of today who have their IMAX with GarageBand and Logic Pro,
yeah.
Have, you know, it's not that long ago when six-piece bands were confined to four tracks.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
If you were lucky, yeah. Flying Nun started off with two tracks, didn't they?
Yeah. So anyway, so Van was like, you know, sitting in his mother's lounge, living back at home with his mum and dad, and his mother was a musician, of course. She played the organ and she played harmonica and things, and he persuaded her to play on these demos that he was making, and of course he was improvising these songs and making them up and doing all this kind of, you know, his mother describes them in fact in an interview as these kind of word plays and these kind of improvised kind of vocal tracks and things he was doing. She was quite astonished by them, but they were the basic the songs that eventually he took to New York when he was finally asked to go to New York. Burt Burns rang him up. You know, there was about a year passed, I think, you know, before Burt Burns got hold of him. He was kind of like a bit of a loss, and he was experiencing that thing and being a pop star, but, you know, frustrating, not knowing what he was going to do next. He'd been dropped by Decca, and he was sending off his demos to other companies like Philips and that, and Philips were listening to them apparently, but they weren't keen to sign him up, and, you know, and Phil Solomon had written him off as a person who was never going to be a professional and all of this. And so, you know, he didn't know what he was going to do. And there's great stories about how he was hanging around. But, you know, in Belfast at that time, it was sort of, there was a growing art scene, you know, art students and art school and musicians everywhere. And, you know, there was all these them-inspired rock bands, actually, rhythm and blues bands that had been kind of, you know, following in the wake of them. And sort of, he was a bit of a local celebrity, but he was broke, you know.
Mm.
He was the sort of celebrity that you couldn't count on to shout everyone a drink at the bar, you know. So, you know, he was in this bind. But then he sort of, out of the blue, he got this call from Burt Burns. Because Burt Burns believed that he could get another hit out of him, you know, because Here Comes the Night had been a fairly big hit. And so he believed in his talent. And, of course, Burt Burns was into the singles market, you know. And so he rang him up, and there was a transatlantic phone call, and he gave him $500 advance, I think, and paid his airfare, and got him over to New York and got him to sign a contract, which turned out to be a bit of a dodgy contract, but there was a recording session came out of it, a two-day recording session, and out of that recording session came this great song, which kind of, in a way, cemented Van Morrison's recording career, the rest of his career, because it became such a hit.
And tell us the name of the song, Paul.
Now, this is a song that you hear on the radio. I guarantee if you turn on the radio today, any station, you'll hear the song sometime through the day. It's called Brown Eyed Girl.
It's a kind of song that every songwriter wishes they'd written.
Yeah, yeah.
Slipping and sliding all along the waterfall with you. A brown eyed girl. We used to sing sha la 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 la, just like that. Sha la 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 la. You have grown. Cast my memory back there a lot. Sometimes I'm overcome thinking about making love in the green grass behind the stadium with you, my brown eyed girl. Are you my brown eyed girl? Do you remember when we used to sing sha la 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 la.
Oh, that's a fantastic track, Paul, doesn't it? Just fill you with good feelings.
Oh, yeah, that is such a great song. He was lucky to have written that song, really. I mean, and he disparaged it later on, but he was very happy when it started hitting the charts and it got into the top 10 in the US. He'd flown back by this stage because they didn't have the budget to keep him in New York. He'd just got him out there for a couple of days. He'd signed this contract and... And the contract involved, you know, giving himself over has been managed by Burt Burns and Bang Records, and
so did he sign away the ownership of the song?
Oh yeah, they owned it. They owned them. Oh. They did everything, and they managed him.
No royalty checks.
He got an advance, and he got, I think there was a 2% or something. I've written it down. 5% record royalty. He was paid $2,500 in advance plus his airfare. The company had the option of retaining the artist for 4 years and 5% record royalty based on US retail price with a 2.5% for recordings released overseas. And Van Morrison was obliged to record a minimum of 12 songs per year. With the company retaining the power to make him record another 50 songs per year if they wanted to. Now, apparently this was a standard contract in those days.
God, that's appalling.
I know. Shocking. Shocking. And the reason it's interesting is that it sort of affected... there's a story in this relationship, Van Morrison's relationship with Bang Records, which I reckon Martin Scorsese should make as a film.
Mm.
Because it involves the mafia, it involves... You know, scenes where the head of Warner Brothers has to pay out $20,000 in cash and go alone to some remote building to release Van Morrison from the contract and all this sort of stuff. And it's just the most phenomenal story. They had, I don't know if you know, Neil Diamond was with Bang Records, right?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he was the other major artist. And, you know, Bang Records was a subsidiary. It was set up by... Burt Burns with Jerry Wexler and Ermit Ertegun, who were with Atlantic Records, right? Originally, that's how it was set up. But Burt Burns broke away from Jerry Wexler and Ermit Ertegun because he had these kind of mafia contacts, right? And the whole thing was that there was all this kind of jukebox thing, yeah, the singles thing. This is why he was so keen to record singles, because the market... At that time, the money was in jukeboxes, and the mafia controlled the jukeboxes. And so when all this crap happened, you know, that Van wanted to get away from Bang Records, he felt his life was threatened. And Neil Diamond apparently had a similar thing, because he'd had a run-in where he was focused. They were focusing on recording singles with Neil Diamond, and Neil Diamond was sick of this. He wanted to be seen as a recording an album artist, you know. And so he sort of fell out with them over a particular song, Shiloh. He wanted to record Shiloh as a single and release it, but they, and Burt Burns said, no, you've got to do more Cherry Cherry type songs. And so he threatened to leave them. And one night they beat up his manager. They interrupted a show Neil Diamond was doing and beat up his manager, you know, because Burt Burns had this heavy... this heavy guy called De Noia, who was an Italian mafioso guy, you know, he used to go around and beat and smash up bootlegging plants with a baseball bat and stuff like this. You know, he was a big threatening kind of guy, and so Neil Diamond, you know, not many people know this, but he had to get his family into hiding, and he asked the New York police for protection. It's hard to believe, isn't it? This is like, and so Van Morrison was in the same boat, you know. Once he went, when he tried to get away from Bang Records, but anyway, look, I'm getting ahead of myself because what I want to do is play a few more tracks from this first session with Bang, because what happened was Burt Burns was a fantastic music producer. There's no doubt about it. You know, he'd worked with some great acts. You know, Solomon Burke. You know, he was, this is, you know, Van Morrison was quite, enamored to be involved with Burt Burns. And I think people, you know, it was a big deal. It was a big deal. He was a huge character in the music scene. And so he got these top musicians in, had this band already when they flew Van in. You know, Eric Gale, I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a great guitarist. Ended up playing on Joe Cocker's records and okay. Paul Simon, I think. One Trick Pony, Eric Gale was playing guitar on that album. Number of top musicians, you know, and here's Van Morrison, young guy, 21 years old, and they're in this New York studio, and he's brought all these songs that he's kind of written in his front room with his mother, and they've just got such a great feel to them, and somehow he picks up this kind of zeitgeist of the New York feel as well, you know, the New York scene. So here's a song called Spanish Rose, which has got a sort of a Latin flamenco kind of feel to it. Beautiful.
About as far away from Belfast, Belfast as you can get.
Yeah, yeah.
The wine beneath the bed, the things we done and said, and all the memories that come glancing back to me in my loneliness. Standing in the breach, the arm that stretched but out of reach, and consciousness has found me sometimes wondering where you're at. Take me back again, take me back one more time, Spanish Road. The way you pull the gate behind you when you said it ain't too late. Come on, let's swing the town and have a ball tonight. And hoping you'd come through, and many others too, and all the friends we used to have in days gone by. I'm wondering if you'll take me back again, take me back one more time, Spanish Road. And when the lights went out, then no one was about, another country in full bloom. In the room we danced, and many hearts were torn, and when the word went round that everything was wrong and just couldn't be put right, it tore me up, it tore me up, love. The way you held a note, the trembling in your thought, that just beginning of your wondrous smile.
The winter winds of days gone by, I often ask myself and wonder why it's gone. Oh, take me back again. Take me back one more time. Spanish Rose. Slumber, you did sleep. The window I did creep and touch your raven hair and sang that song again to you. You did not even wince. You thought I was the prince to come and take you from your misery and lonely castle wall. Take me back again. Take me back one more time. Spanish Rose.
There we go. Spanish Rose, Van Morrison.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's beautiful. I mean, it's like, it's got the feel, you know, as I was playing it with Matthew Bannister the other night and just sort of checking out the tracks to play on this program, actually, and Matthew was saying this song has got the feel of The Drifters and Benny King, and it's also, it reminds, it's got that same sort of feel that Mink DeVille did later in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, that sort of Latin rock that, so, you know, it's quite, it's amazing stuff.
He's got such a great voice.
Yeah. Terrific. Golden voice. It's got that sort of nasal quality, but it's very powerful. It's a very powerful, very wide sort of sound to it. So they, as I say, there was a big, the big thing with these recording sessions in New York was the contrast, you know, the tension, I guess, between Burt Burns' desire for a single,
yes,
and the commercial interests of Burt Burns, and the artistic ambition of Van Morrison.
Because at this stage, at this era, we're beginning to see the album emerging as a really legitimate art form, aren't
Absolutely.
We?
Yeah.
You know, we're just about to get, you know, all these concept albums from the Beatles and other bands, and The Who, they're about to start appearing.
Yeah.
And every artist wants to have an album because it says,
yes,
I am a real artist.
Yes. And so what happened was that, you know, Van was producing these songs in these kind of bluesy, experimental type of, extended kind of improvisations, if you like. Some of them are just utterly brilliant. We'll play one a bit later called TB Sheets, you know. There was an attempt to get another single like Brown Eyed Girl, of course, and this was the Summer of Love, you know, as you say, the sort of the concept album was coming out. Sergeant Pepper was there. The Monterey Pop Festival was happening. That was in about, what was that, July 1967 or something.
And drugs were changing the paradigm of music.
Absolutely. I think Paul McCartney was on the cover of Life magazine, was it, or Time, expounding the qualities of LSD.
Yes.
You know, it was just an incredible time. Incredible time. And, like you say, the album was... was there, and Van Morrison had ambition to record an album, of course, and that's what he wanted to do. But these, you know, he didn't really have the confidence of a producer to do that, and the producer he was with was interested in getting a hit single. So I thought we'll play the next attempt at a hit single, which I think is a great track. It's called Row Row Rosie. Yeah.
Hey. grown. She never go out on her own. She live way up on the avenue of trees. Why can't they walk in the cool night breeze?
It's a great track. I mean, it really is a great track, but I can see why it flopped. It's it's not really commercial.
Yes, it didn't do the thing that Brown Eyed Girl did, though. You know, it's probably more of a pure blues kind of experiment, isn't it? You know, sort of improvises blues. But the thing is that what happened is Van Morrison, you know, they flew him back to Belfast, and he was kind of like in limbo again, you know, after doing this recording session. And then Brown Eyed Girl hit the charts, and it was like, so they flew him back, and this time they did it for good. And the interesting thing is that he had kept in touch with this woman called Janet, Janet Gelder, I think was her married name. She was married and then divorced, and she had a 5-year-old son. And once he got to New York, she moved in with him. They set him up in a hotel in Broadway and just opposite the Bang Records offices, and she moved in, and that was it. She brought the son. And it was kind of like, the interesting thing, it was like Van Morrison suddenly had this family, you know. But anyway, I wanted to play a song called TV Sheets. Just a bit of a song. We won't play the whole thing. The whole thing's about 9 minutes long, but yeah. So we'll just play the end of it. It's interesting because it's a really intense kind of blues song. It just really shows you the roots of Van Morrison's music in the blues. And there's a John Lee Hooker song called TV Sheets, actually. But it evokes, you know, it's the whole thing is permeated with the feeling of death. You know, there's no doubt about it. It's a heavy experience. And, you know, reputedly, he burst into tears at the end of the recording because it was so intense to get it down. And it's just a very powerful experience to listen to the whole thing, but it's got this kind of, play it now.
The cool room, la, la, to the fool's room, and I can almost smell your TV sheets. I can almost smell your TV sheets. TV. I
Chicago. Santa won in mumbles later on, eh? See what I can pick up for you, you know. Yeah, I got a few things going, too. Don't worry about it, don't worry about it, don't worry. Uh-huh. Go, go, go.
Well, I'm coming in a little bit earlier as the song fades out, but that is just about as authentic blues as you can get.
Oh yeah, it's a stunning song. I mean, if you listen to the whole thing, which we've only come in, like we came in about 6 minutes into it because it's just too long to play on the session. But it's I really recommend people get this record and have a listen to this because it's a very moving recording, you know, and you wonder where it comes from. I mean, it evokes the history of Belfast because, you know, TB was a big an issue in 19th century Belfast. Hundreds of people died of it, thousands. Mm. And also it's got that blues thing, as I say, the John Lee Hooker song called TB Sheets. There's a history of songs about TB and the blues. But there's also the personal experience that Van brings to it as well. You know, he had a girlfriend in London during the them days called Dee, and she died of a brain hemorrhage. And she was kind of like a mother figure to Van at that time. You know, he was like 18, 19, and she was looking after him. And then he had his aunt Gloria, you know, who he wrote the song Gloria about. Gloria Gordon, who was a kind of a very powerful figure in his life, you know, sort of a maternal kind of figure. And she died at the age of about 29, I believe. So he'd suffered, by the stage, he'd suffered some incredible losses in his life.
Which, so his voice is authentic.
Oh, well, no doubt about it. And the blues thing, you know, the blues, they say, you know, you've got to sell your soul to the devil to sing the blues. And I think Van, in a way, Van somehow did. There's something about Van Morrison that you can just think, you know, he's just got this thing. And it's just such a talent. It's such a raw, powerful talent, but it's so there and he can't stop it. He has to do it, you know.
Now, I'm not gonna diminish the Rolling Stones, but compared to Van Morrison, they were well-educated, middle-class boys without too much tragedy in their lives.
Yeah.
When you hear Van's story, you realise that they're playing very different. They're trying to emulate their American blues, black blues heroes.
Yeah.
Van is the blues.
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
I would agree with that. I think there's a certain degree of truth in that. The Stones are the English guys, you know, trying to emulate their black heroes, and I mean, sure, Van, you know, you can talk about Van. He, when he played in the show bands, you know, he was in a band called the Monarchs when he was about 16, and they toured Germany. And the first time he'd ever met black people, you know, they were playing to the GIs in Germany, and some of them were blacks. And, you know, he would sit down and he would do these stories of how, you know, the other band members, they couldn't find him, but, you know, they'd find this group of black soldiers that he'd be sitting with, and, you know, talking about the music with, you know, and that was it. He was like a magnet to him.
So we've come to the end of the Bang sessions, and what's the next move for Van?
Well, he had to run away to, you know, as I've said, the mafia thing, you know, the what happened is Burt Burns died suddenly, and it changed everything, of course. You know, he died at the age of 38 of a heart attack. He'd been born with a congenital heart condition, so it was apparently no surprise to him that
so
he died.
So young.
He was preparing for it happening, apparently, yes, which is part of the reason why he hung out with gangsters, because, you know, he didn't sort of seem to care about risks.
Yes, yes.
But he hung out with some of the top gangsters in New York, apparently. You know, guys like what's his name? Costello. There's a guy who was, running all the jukeboxes and so on, and had control over the nightclubs and the gay bars and all of that. And so, you know, Burt Burns was apparently a man that was attracted to this sort of thing. And when he died, the business was inherited by his young wife, mm-hmm. who was apparently like, you know, she was a teenager. He was 38. She was like just out of being a teenager, and she'd had a couple of kids to him and so on. I think she'd just given birth to a baby before he died. She inherited the business, and anyway, they had this guy, this mafia guy called Denoya, Carmine Wassel Denoya, and he was this heavy guy, and he tried to intimidate Van Morrison, banged on the door of his hotel. You know, he was shacked up there with Janet Planet in this hotel on Broadway, and he's banging on the door saying, "You'll never work in the business again, in the music business again."
I'll never work in the business again.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's Scorsese stuff. Yeah. And so, you know, Van Morrison and Janet Planet, you know, they sort of realised this is serious stuff. They got to get out of here. So they left town, literally. They had to leave, and, you know. So they went to Boston. And it was while hanging out in Boston, he spent a number of months up there hanging out in Boston, once again broke, you know, there's description. They met this guy called Peter Wolf. I don't know if anyone's heard of Peter Wolf. He set up the J. Geals band.
Okay,
And he became a friend and a mentor to Van and recognised his talent. He describes, there's descriptions of the way Van was living in this little flat in Boston, you know, with a mattress on the floor, and the only thing they had really was this expensive tape recorder that he still managed to carry around with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was still recording these songs, which, you know, ended up becoming the songs of Astral Weeks. So anyway, he was hanging out, and he was doing a very interesting thing. He was recruiting musicians from the Boston Music School, which apparently, I believe, it's called the Berklee Music School of Boston. Apparently, it's got a huge reputation these days. And he was sort of hanging out trying to recruit musicians. And he came up with this guy called Tom Kilbarnia. And another guy called John Payne. And Tom Kilbarnia was a bassist, and John Payne was a clarinetist and a flautist. And he sort of got a number of others, and he had this rock band, but he got sick of the rock band thing. He said, "Oh, I'm sick of playing rock music. I want to play folk stuff. You know, I want to play this acoustic stuff." So they were playing, you know, they were touring clubs, they were doing clubs, and so Peter Wolf was getting them these gigs in the various clubs and so on around the place.
This is not to be confused with Peter and the Wolf.
No. Peter Wolf, Peter Wolf, the guy that set up J. Geals band. He was getting a mixed reaction from things. He's playing these songs, and they're quite improvisational vocally and so on, and they had this kind of jazz folk feel. And eventually, through a very sort of long-winded kind of connection, the guy from Warner Brothers signed him up. And it was a guy called Louis Merenstein, who'd worked with Thelonious Monk and a number of other jazz artists. And the vice president, Joe Smith, and Joe Smith was the vice, you know, the vice president of Warner Brothers, who was the guy that had to pay out the $20,000 to the Bang Mafia guys, you know, the wise guys, you know. And he was told to meet in this sort of place and, you know, in this abandoned building and come alone with $20,000 in cash, you know, stuff.
He's got the money.
Yeah, and there's this sort of quote from Joe Smith, you know, that he's the vice president of Warner Brothers, you know, how he said when he left the room, he thought that was it, they're going to hit me over the head and you've lost $20,000 and Van Morrison, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he sort of realized once he got out of the room, he jumped over the sort of the footpath and so on and ran across the street and got out of there as fast as he could. And he said, that was my foray into the career of Van Morrison, you know. That was I mean, that's just horrendous stuff, isn't it?
Sorry, carry on.
Well, they signed him up and they took him in, down to New York, back to New York, and amazingly he could show his face there again. And wasn't too scared to. But, yeah, they took him into a studio and they said that the guy, you know, these guys from Boston Music School came with them. You know, they, by this stage they'd realised what a genius they were working with, these two musicians, you know, and this flautist John Payne, who was always wanting to be a musician and so on, didn't know how to do it. And he'd suddenly just fallen on his feet. And then they're in the studio and the Warner Brothers guy said, look, sorry guys, we're gonna get these top musicians in. You know, they got this guy called Richard Davis, who was like had worked with Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan and a number of others. Jay Berliner, who'd worked with Charlie Mingus, you know, and these top jazz guys, Jay Berliner guitar and Connie Kay on drums, Warren Smith Jr. on percussion, you know, and this other flautist guy whose name has not been recorded because he only played on a couple of tracks, but yeah, you know, at some point, you know, and John Payne, the Boston music student, was just hanging in there to watch, you know, because they were just so in awe of Van by the stage, and then the bass player as well. And the bass player wasn't too upset when he was told they were going to get this other bass player in because he said, oh, come on, yeah, that Richard Davis, he's my god, you know. So he was just happy to watch, you know. So anyway, the flautist that they'd got in sort of up and left, you know, he got sick of waiting for his part or something, so they gave the flute to John Payne and the Boston student. So he ended up playing on most of the tracks on Astral Weeks.
Strangely enough, when I think of Astral Weeks, I think of the flute.
Yeah, so most of the tracks are played by this Boston student who was only about 18 or something.
Now, it's an extraordinary album, but it really didn't take off.
No, it didn't sell, but it's sort of...
It's picked up and it became a cult thing, didn't it?
Yeah.
And eventually it became a classic album.
Yeah, and to the Warner Brothers guy's merit, you know, this guy Lewis Merenstein, he apparently was committed to producing a work of art because they'd heard the demos that Van was recording on this recording equipment that he'd had, you know, this tape deck. And they had this belief in him as an artist, and these guys were you know, they'd worked with jazz guys, you know, so here they brought this jazz sensibility, you know, and this producer they got in, and they obviously had this commitment to doing a work of art as opposed to a commercial piece, you know. So you got to hand it to them, you know.
Well, let's have a listen.
Yeah, let's listen to the first track. It's called Astral Weeks.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, steel rims crack and a dead center back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes to lay me down to silence easy to be born again? To be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me, and push another door.
again. To be born again. Talking to you to let me showing pictures on the wall, whispering in the hall. I'm pointing a finger at me.
Announced to various people that I was doing a Van Morrison special with you, music aficionados, a lot of eye rolling, like, oh, Van Morrison, you know. But you've got to say, this, he is a unique voice.
Oh, yeah.
There was nothing else like this.
No, I mean,
his time.
That's right. I think Astral Weeks is one of the great albums ever made. You quite often see it in lists of the top 10 ever albums, and I would say it's definitely up there in my view. Here's something that Greil Marcus said about it. The music that resulted wasn't jazz, it wasn't blues, it wasn't rock and roll in any ordinary or hyphenated manner, but it fit perfectly on the radio in between Jimi Hendrix's Little Wing or Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness. It was closer to folk music and closer to Barbara Allen or the Irish ballad Raglan Road than We Shall Overcome or even Goodnight Irene.
Mm.
I think that's a really nice little description of it. You know, it's a phenomenal piece of music. It's very simple chord structures, very basic sort of almost three chord bluesy structures, but the very folky feel, but an improvised kind of jazz kind of almost scat singing kind of feel to them, to the songs. and the when you think that he was like 21 years old, 22 I think by this stage. Yeah, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, but at my grand age of 52, I look back and I think, 21.
Yeah.
21. I was an idiot at 21.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
He's a phenomenal talent just arrived on the scene with this album in many ways, because not many people, people only knew the Brown Eyed Girl track and some people hadn't even heard that. And so when this came out, it was like they realized they had something. And I mean, you could hear the strings on there. Those strings are overdubbed, by the way. The sessions were, the sessions were just Van on acoustic with the bass and the drums and the flute and then the strings were overdubbed.
Now we have just about run out of time, Paul. We're going to come back next week and we're going to start exploring Moondance. Mm. Unfortunately, we've only got time for one more track. We're going to play something a little bit odd. From his contractual obligation.
Yeah,
album.
Well, what happened was there was a contract. The contract with Bang hadn't. The Warner Brothers guy had the meeting with the Mafia and they'd paid out the $20,000 to get to free him up. But he still, that's part of the deal was that he still had to deliver these 36 songs, which was part of his original track to Eileen, the Eileen Burns who'd inherited the business. And so he had to do these 36 songs, right? And the other part of the contract was he had to record two songs on his Warner Brothers album that he'd recorded with Bang.
Hmm.
So that's the reason why Madam George and Beside You are on Astral Weeks, right? Because they were recorded with Bang originally.
Okay.
So there's Bang versions of those songs, which are fascinating. That's a study in itself, the difference between those versions. But. Yeah. But and so part of that there was 2% of royalties from Warner's had to go to Bang and so on, and the publishing royalties and so on, and then he had another arrangement. But anyway, we're listening to this now.
We'll listen to this, and it's called.
Hold on, this is the big royalty check.
We'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Paul.
And it still hasn't come yet. It's about a year overdue. I guess it's coming from the big royalty check in the sky. I waited and the mailman never dropped it in my letterbox. It's a big royalty check in the sky. Ooh, baby. But you can beat the tax man and me.
For more episodes of this Community Access Radio show, please visit freefm.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast possible through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.